Okay, hi everybody. I've got all this class and all those people online. Welcome to our review of the module called The Wisdom of Empires. So before we get into the actual teaching, we will set our motivation. We'll do a visualization practice and we'll take refuge together and generate a mind of enlightenment. So please get comfortable in your seat. This means basically your feet are flat on the floor or on a cushion, your back is nice and straight, and your head is evenly balanced on your neck. And you can close your eyes or keep them open. So allow your body to breathe itself. And as your body breathes itself, notice the movements that take place whenever you inhale or exhale the breath. So find any place within the body where your awareness of the breath is easily formed, and just place your attention there. You'll feel that the mind is more focused and the body is gradually coming to relax more and more. So with the body relaxed and the mind focused, it's very easy to imagine the presence of all the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas in the room with you. I think that they're sort of in space above the crown of your head. While the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas and all of the other enlightened beings are in the space above you, think that you are surrounded by all sentient beings. This vast crowd of people include your mother, father, brothers and sisters, your closest friends, difficult people and strangers. And then take a moment to recollect what you have in common with your mother and father, your brothers and sisters, friends, your enemies and strangers. So one thing you could recollect is that we all wish to be happy and none of us wish to experience suffering. And although we have a wish for happiness and a wish to avoid suffering, these two wishes have not yet been met. So we still experience suffering, but we don't have the happiness we could have. So put an end to our own suffering, to develop genuine happiness for ourselves, and to help others do the same, we can take refuge in the enlightened beings in front of us, in the teachings that they present, and in them as a spiritual community. So think that you're going to lead all beings in the process of taking refuge in authentic teachers and authentic teachings and authentic spiritual community as one of the means to help you put an end to suffering and its causes and to develop all of the good qualities. So say, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So in response to this aspiration of yours, think that lights and nectars pour out of the heart of the Buddha, and they wash over you and over all the beings surrounding you. The light and nectar removes any type of hindrance or obstacle to achieving the happiness you're wishing for, removing any obstacle that keeps suffering perpetually. And I think if you've come under the care of the Buddha, his teachings, and the community, you gaze around, see you're still surrounded by all beings, they're still suffering. You make a wish that they have love and compassion, joy and equanimity, and you yourself will develop these four immeasurable qualities. And so you say, may all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Again, in response to this prayer of yours, lights and nectars pour out of the heart of the Buddha, they wash over you and over all the beings surrounding you. Light and nectar removes any hindrance or obstacle, and the four immeasurable qualities are now possessed by you and by all beings surrounding you. Then, recollecting the field of merit above you, feel devotion to them and say, reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time and rejoice in the merit of all whole and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. So by engaging in this practice, we've put in place a cause for us to stop our own greed and miserliness and any type of clinging we have. The thing that your body transforms into emptiness, then reappears as a pure universe. We're going to give it to the Buddha and the Bodhisattvas. So reciting with me, this ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned round here in four continents of southern wind. I imagine this is a good field of offer. May all living beings endure this pure land. Idam Guru Rakamandala Kamayatayam. The offering has been released. The Buddha accepts it and he smiles at us. And we look up into his eyes. And we feel accepted and at ease. And then an emanation of the Buddha leaves his heart. It moves through space. It comes to abide above the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. The emanation descends, enters the crown of your head, comes down through your body, and stops at the level of your heart. Then its radiance begins to expand and fills your body and mind with light. And the light goes out through the pores of your skin and starts to fill the 10 directions of space. When the 10 directions of space are filled with light, you realize that you brought all beings to the fully awakened state, and there's no difference between yourself and anyone else. And the light begins to withdraw from the 10 directions of space and it re-enters your heart. You feel yourself sitting on your chair and you know that you're breathing normally and naturally. You understand that the meditation you've done has been on the level of imagination, and it has imprinted your mind with a cause to become enlightened for the benefit of others. So accept that and think, today I've done something very meaningful and useful. And I'm going to continue living my life in a meaningful way. And then you breathe in deeply through your nostrils and exhale through the mouth. And in your own time, you allow your eyes to flutter open and you move your hands and body whichever way you'd like to, so you feel quite present. Okay, so again, this is the material I've been relying upon, plus a few more books as well, but probably the easiest book to start with if you want to tackle this topic called emptiness is this middle one called How to See Yourself as You Really Are. I say that because it's brief, right to the point, the language is easy to understand, and it's full of meditations. At the very end of the book, all the meditations are put together. So you can just go from one to another. And the meditations are not very long. So it's a very useful book. And then after that, of course, all of these, I like them all. So what can I say? The book, Insight into Emptiness, is a very good book. I suggest you try and own it. Because if you want to go further with this understanding of emptiness, you'll get teachings from other Buddhist masters. And the language they use is the same language as it's written in Insight into Emptiness. That's where it's very useful. You get used to the terms and the way they speak about it. Now today we're going to have a look at the exam and assessment questions, and I'm going to come up with their answers. So there are 18 altogether. So I thought this is how we could do our review. So I'm going to begin it because we've basically covered all the material anyway in the last 8 weeks, but today we do it in one day. So we start asking ourselves, what is this thing called emptiness? So we can start by saying what it's not and by what it is, and then you get an idea of what's not and what it is. So first of all, emptiness is not nothing. It's not nihilism either. So nihilism is this belief in that nothing exists. And you can make that incorrect assumption if you misunderstand emptiness. Well, I'll tell you now, it's not nihilism, and neither is it nothing. The other thing is it's not depressing. However, it can be if you misunderstand what the meaning is. And lastly, it's not a doctrinal belief. So that means it's not like what we call dogma. If somebody tells you something, you must believe this. That's not required of you. You can discover emptiness through your own process of reasoning, which leads us to what emptiness is. So what is this? It's this, what they say, the final mode of existence. It's the ultimate truth. And finally, and very importantly, it's a non-affirming negation. So I put them in this order because as an acronym, it spells fun. So remember, emptiness is fun. It's the final mode of existence. It's the ultimate truth. That's a non-affirming negation. Emptiness is fun.
I want the t-shirt. And then I want the detail in the t-shirt underneath it.
It's the fun quarter, because it's the quality of all existence and its reality. So I often do this myself just to remember. And it's a simple way for me to remember it. Now, what does emptiness do? What does the wisdom that realized emptiness do? What's the purpose of understanding it? Well, it puts an end to ignorance. And from a Buddhist perspective, ignorance is the fundamental cause of all of our problems, of all of our suffering. Now, if we could realize emptiness, we'd get rid of ignorance, we wouldn't be suffering. So what is this ignorance? Because there's many meanings to ignorance. So first of all, it's bad knowledge. It's a very simple way to think of it. Secondly, it's misknowledge. That's why it's bad, right? It's a force that actively opposes knowing, proper knowing. So it's like, this was a clock and you thought it was a car. So you've got knowledge of something if it's wrong, isn't it? That's what this type of knowledge is. So it's not the knowledge. There are two types of ignorance in general. One is you just don't know something. And there's lots of things we don't know. But that's not the root cause of our problems. So for many of us, and many non-Buddhists, they don't know about karma. They don't know about Buddha nature. They don't know a lot of things, right? Just like us, we don't know a lot of things too. And that's problematic in some ways, which it is. But then there's this other knowledge, and this is the ignorance, where you actually think you know something that's true, but you're wrong. That's what we mean by ignorance here. We're sure of something, but we're wrong. And so what we're sure of and where we're wrong is, we're sure of who we are and how we exist and the things that are around us. We're sure of that. And we're wrong. That's basically it. And when we're sure of things, we've got lots of ideas about them, but basically we're wrong in the first place, so all the ideas are wrong. Compounds it. They call the proliferation of conception, of thoughts. You've got more and more and more thoughts about what you think is true. But basically, you're wrong from the get-go. So the idea here is to look at these two ways that we can be wrong, primarily about ourselves and the external world. And we talk about the emptiness, the wisdom of emptiness that realizes who you actually are and your relationship to the world. So you can sort of divide it into two parts, yourself and everything else. Now this type of ignorance is described and it's given many different ways, different terms. So one is called self, grasping itself. That's one way of talking about this ignorance. Another is sort of grasping that inherent existence. Another one is grasping that true existence. What's the one that Kintsa Rinpoche often uses? It's the one where what's it called? She does this all the time.
From there.
No, it's about the five aggregates, I think. The disintegration, the disintegrating aggregates. The innate view of the transitory collection. Thank you, Sue. So you get lots of different terms. And why you've got so many different terms is to suit the many different people. Oh, that's a great term. That matters. I can work with that. Whereas some other term you might not resonate with it all. There's plenty of different ways of talking about the ignorance. And here, the deepest and most subtle thing that we are empty of is called inherent existence. And that's also called, in brief, self. So if you grasp at self, you're grasping at inherent existence, you're grasping at the innate view of the transitory or perishing, transitory collection. All of these things, it all means the same. And of course, then you have this word self. So that also has different meanings. But here, the meaning is referring to this ignorance. So here I put the start, inherent existence meaning self. And this is ignorance, right? Wrong views. And there's number of ways of describing it again. And I want to put up first Chandrakirti's because it's very simple to remember. So he describes inherent existence. He actually came up with the term. He was the first one to come up with the term. Buddha never used it, Nagarjuna never used it. Chandrakirti did. And he describes this as being any nature or state that objects could have in which they rely on nothing else. Now, another thing I would like to give to you is when you get little definitions like this, it's really good if you can hang on to it. So you all let us know what we're talking about. So one of the simplest ways of memorizing definitions is you just take the first letter of each word. and you break it up into chunks. So here you go, so I go, A-N-O-S, anos, anos, any natural state. So you say, any natural state, A-N-O-S, any natural state. What's the next one? That that objects could have, or that objects could. So P-O-C, any nature or state that objects could have, in which they rely on nothing else. So oftentimes, if you just get half of it or you start it, the rest will come to you. This is how actors memorize all their lines in the movies. It's one of, like I said, it's the most simplest way that you can do this. Just take one letter of the first word, you say it a few times, and then you'll get in there. The nature of state, which that objects could have, which they rely on, nothing else. It's a very brief thing to say. Lama Tsongkhapa himself said it in a different way, but it's, the meaning is the same. Here he says, what exists objectively? What exists objectively in terms of its own essence without being posited through the power of a subjective mind? So there's a lot more words to say, but you can see it's also quite meaty, isn't it? When you start looking at this, you go, something is like, you know, I'm a subject, objective. Objective existence. It's real. It doesn't require me, doesn't require a mind to know it. It exists in and of itself. So you break these things down and try and see it in your own mind, what they're talking about.
So this is like going against the myth of objectivity.
That's dead right. So if you know that, like, most of the Western world, the science world, this is the view that he's saying this doesn't exist. In reality, it doesn't exist. It's like there's an objective view. We're here, and all that's called the objects. And it exists as it appears to you. For instance, when you walk outside, you look up at the sky is the object that we're engaged with, right? You look at the sky, that's the object. What's it look like to you? It all looks blue, doesn't it? You walk out there, you go, blue. Where's the blue? Over there. Well, guess what? There's no blue over there. Why did science tell you that? Why does it look blue? So we know why it looks blue also. But the blue's not out there. But it looks like it's out there. And Lama Tsongkhapa is saying, that's exactly what he's saying. There's no world existing objectively without mind playing a part in it, without your awareness playing a part in it. That does not exist. Then you go, okay, so what's the reverse of that then? You gotta go, okay, so the blue is dependent upon my awareness. Anything that exists requires awareness before it can exist. That's what he's getting at. And if you know, you've got to play around with it and take the opposite view and go, no, I don't believe you. And then you try it out and say, well then, let's see, if I'm saying no, it means I'm saying that I can know something without having awareness of it. Is that possible? And the answer is no. But the only way you know anything is because you know it. And how do you know anything? Through your senses and your consciousness. If you don't have consciousness, you know, you're caught dead, aren't they? The corpses don't know anything, right? They're dead. You go, why? There's no intelligence there, there's no awareness there. In fact, without the awareness, they're dead. The corpse can't tell you anything. As soon as you put awareness there, hello, a whole lot of things start happening. So he's saying here, for anything to take place to be known requires mind, requires awareness. And at the same time, he's sort of saying, and guess what? Your awareness can mislead you as well as lead you to the truth. So it misleads us when we think the sky is actually blue and it's out there of having an objective existence. We're misled there. So that's like one of the things out there, but then our awareness also misleads us about who we are and how we exist.
And that's the one that's the most relevant.
Yep, that's
to
right.
Us.
To us, yeah.
Think about the nature of the stars, which quantum physics does. It goes through all this and it starts the
thinking, oh, you know, maybe it does depend on a subjective mind, but it still doesn't help us in any way,
No, it doesn't bring you to any sort of ethical conclusions or moral way of being in the world. Yeah, so they know that whatever appears to us depends upon our measuring instrumentation. And it's just like us, you know, whatever appears out there depends upon consciousness. That's how we measure things. It's our only way of knowing. Animals are the same. And so they use their awareness and their senses. We in science use instruments. And then that's how we tell things. Without the instrument, you don't know about that thing. The other thing is that your knowledge about that thing depends upon the instrument. So here we have a dependent relationship. You have a dependent relationship, you don't have objective existence. That's pretty amazing, I think, was, you know, like growing up in school, you know, probably all of you, and yeah, there was this view put forward as a really objective world. And I remember teachers saying, look at it objectively, and I'm thinking, how can you? You know, and I was like, that was really confusing for me. I just thought, well, if you think of objective, you've got to pull yourself out of the picture. If you do that, what picture is there? Like, you don't know the picture if you're not in the picture. Right? So it's very confusing. And then, you know, like 50 years later, they say, yeah, you know, you know what you're thinking about? So, the point of having this wisdom that realizes emptiness is that you realize that whatever does exist does so dependently. So dependent upon your senses, your reasoning, and science and instrument. So dependence destroys ignorance that thinks of objective existence. So as Ari Davis said this, he was Nagarjuna's major pupil and disciple. So he says, all afflictions are overcome through overcoming ignorance. When dependent arises in the scene, ignorance does not arise. It is the only doorway to peace. It destroys wrong views. It captures the attention of all Buddhas. This is called selflessness. So in other words, he's saying these objects don't have the self that we think they do, meaning their identity is not intrinsic to the object. Now, all of these teachings on selflessness and emptiness, or the wisdom realizing either of us two, have all come down from the Buddha himself. And this is a demarcation of what we call Buddhism and any other religion or philosophy in the world. I think it's in the 1800s, there have been some Western philosophers that have come very, very close to this, including the same similar views, but not tied in with the ethical side of it. So here is a something a chart to help us sort of understand some of these teachings, because in the examination paper they ask you, who are the teachers of this selflessness? So first of all, looks in the text, it says the two Buddhas, because Nagarjuna is actually seen as another enlightened being. So you've got Buddha Shakyamuni, then you have Nagarjuna. And if you do a little bit of reading or read that last quote, you'll know Nagarjuna had a spiritual son called Aryadeva. Those two guys, they're the middle way proponents. Then out of that, after that, was Vasubandhu and Asanga. They were two brothers. Then in the middle way, which is what we're concerned with here, it's a tenet system. We have Bhava Viveka, and he was the founder of the middle way autonomy school. Now, Manoa was Buddha Palita and Chandrakirti. Now they worked with the middle way consequence school. And one of the greatest middle way consequences of all was Arya Shantideva, who wrote The Bodhisattva's Way of Life. You've got these Indians in Tibet, Shantarakshita and Kamalashila. Shantarakshita was the guru of Kamalashila. These two guys were meditators, logicians, and Shantarakshita brought the Buddha Dharma to Tibet. He was the man who ordained the first Tibetan monks, and he brought with him a philosophy which was not the middle way consequence. And this is why I've put these dates in it. So the first type of reasoning sort of thing about how things existed came through Shantarakshita. And it was not middle way consequence, it wasn't mind only either. It's like we'll see shortly when we go to the next slide. Then Atisha came, then Lama Tsongkhapa, and the middle way consequence really took off in Tibet about 1300. So I put all these up here like this to so you can actually see a progression of dates. To go, because you know, the assumption is, oh yeah, okay, the Tibetans, they've had a middle way consequence all the way. Go, no, they didn't.
Forever.
Yeah, forever, right? Because it's the big thing, it's the major thing. You go, no, it wasn't like that. It was a gradual process. First of all, they had did all these other things, and then only later on. Chandrakirti himself, seen as the founder, was like, I don't know, maybe 500 or 600 years before his view was actually appreciated for what it was. In his own time, he's nobody. 500 years, no one recognized what he'd actually done. And then later, and then like Lama Tsongkhapa made him a real big deal. And there were very few other people in Tibet at the time who had the proper way of looking at what is the middle. So it took a bit of time to get this right. In fact, I was reading last night some stuff to Miffy about Lama Tsongkhapa. So I've been reading Lama Tsongkhapa's biography. And you know, Lama Tsongkhapa, to get the correct view, he had to actually talk to Manjushri, who's an embodiment of wisdom itself. And so he asked Manjushri, did his own teacher have the correct view of emptiness? Works. And then he asked Manjushri, he said, look, you know, he said, you know, do I have it? You know, he says, look, I don't. You know, is my view this one or that one? He says, it's neither. You don't have the view of emptiness either. It's like, wow. You know, so Manjushri helped him to understand. And like I was saying to him, if you last time, I read all these great letters between Manjushri and between Lama Tsongkhapa and his teachings, Rendawa. Right? And then gradually over time, his teacher, the positions changed. You know? It's really a beautifully written book. It's very interesting. But generally for our examination purposes, if you want to do them, this question is in there. You know, so like I said, for me it's very simply go two Buddhas, two brothers, and there's this middle way thing. You get, and what else is there? A couple of Indians and Tibetan Tibetans.
And then Lama Tsongkhapa is like 500 years after Chandrakirti, and then pretty much in His Holiness the Dalai Lama.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
500 odd years after that.
Yeah. And Lama Tsongkhapa really changed the understanding of what it meant for things to be empty. So he himself was not satisfied with the way that emptiness was explained. And so, you know, on his journey, he came up with this new understanding of it. And so sometimes you'll see in the text, there's a period like before Lama Tsongkhapa and after. But, you know, one of the views of the middle way before Lama Tsongkhapa's presentation was that the consequences, what you know later became called middle way consequences, didn't have a view. So what they would do is sit there and go, well, what's your view? And you'd explain, they'd just shoot you down. And they go, well, what's yours? And they'd go, there's nothing to be said about the view.
So that's why they call consequentialists.
Yeah, that's right. We refute all views, but we don't hold any ourselves. And that's what they used to do. And that's it. And you sort of abide in a meditative state where nothing's really going on. You're just sort of open. And so Lama Tsongkhapa wasn't happy with that idea. And so, so this is this whole journey and what he discovered. So what he discovered came through meditation and reasoning. This is another big difference about Lama Tsongkhapa, how he was able to take some of the previous teachers' teachings on reasoning and integrate it into the spiritual process. You know, sometimes you might have heard it said, you know, like, that all conceptions are basically useless in a way. You know, so, like, thinking is a problem. Whether it's good thinking or bad thinking, you're still thinking. That's, you're never going to get there that way.
All conceptions are erroneous.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's another thing that Lama Tsongkhapa didn't like at all either. But he was able to integrate thinking and reasoning into the Buddha Dharma. Other people had done it, but he really pushed it together, especially in what later became the Gurupa tradition. And so these things are called established conclusions. That's what a tenet is. You think about something and you establish something from it. That's your conclusion. So imagine you're thinking about yourself. So this is like I was saying, I was at a party over the weekend, this guy was talking, so I asked him some questions and very quickly, like, you know, you find like you don't know. You know, so I said, so why? You see this thing, why? What's your reason? And it just stops people. People don't have reasons. But here these guys say, no, reasoning is really important. If you make a statement about something, we'll ask you why. And if your answer is not reasonable, we're going to challenge it. And so this type of thing is you do it to yourself. You ask questions about yourself or phenomena, just like a scientist would. And you know, if the scientist is mistaken, somebody else will come along and show it to them. And you have to change your view. The same with yourself. Right? So you establish these conclusions about how things exist. And through this establishment, there are some things that all the Buddhist schools agree on. And then after that, there's a lot of things they disagree on. So what do they all agree on? It's called the Four Seals. And this confirms whether you are a Buddhist or not, especially through reasoning. And the first is that all products are impermanent. Yeah. Second is that all contaminated phenomena are miserable. Third is all phenomena are empty and selfless, and nirvana is peace. So they ask you this question too in the exam. That's why, of course, the slide is there. What are the four seals? And the first seal is related to the truth of dukkha, and the second to the truth of origin. The third is to the truth of cessation, and the fourth to the truth of path. So you know that these four truths are, you know, the first teaching that the Buddha gave. And you can take that for that suffering, because it's a product, is impermanent. It is suffering because it's a contaminated phenomena. And so what's it contaminated with? Yeah. Karma and delusion. Because like I said before, if you think you know something is true, but you're wrong. That's just delusion. A lot of activities follow from that. And they're all based in this delusion. And guess what happens? You suffer. And that suffering, it's impermanent. It's subject to change. So the phenomena that you think are actually true and exist the way you think they do, don't. That means they're empty of what you think is true. They don't hold that type of identity. And so that's, you know, there's some major differences in the off. So that's, you've got a lot of different opinions there. And these different opinions took the forms of what they call the four tenet systems, four schools of thought about how things exist. And two of them are put into what they call the individual vehicle schools. And the names of them in English are Great Exposition and Sutra. The Sanskrit is called Vaibhashika and Sautrantika. And these two schools are called individual vehicle schools because the tenets, the conclusions established through their reasoning, lead to personal liberation. Where the next two lead to universal emancipation. They're called Mahayana tenet systems. Your name's in English, I know, but in Sanskrit, my name is also Gautama. These schools have got many, many divisions within them. Like, for instance, if we go back one, the Great Exposition is 18 different schools in there. So if you think back, you go right back to the Buddha's given his teachings, and then we're all sitting around like this discussing them, working out, what did he mean when he said that? What did he mean when he said this? And sometimes you could ask him, and he'd tell you. But of course, he passed away, and then we've got all these people left still wondering, what did he mean when he said this? So people come with all these different ideas, and groups of people have split off and go, well, that's a school of thought, but there's another one. And you think they're all over India, all thinking about this material, but not coming into contact with each other. And they've all got these ideas.
And then they bring forth different elements of those ideas according to their personalities.
Yeah, and what they call sutras. So there's a lot of sutras. So some of these people go, well, this is the one we're talking about here, and independence upon this, this is what we think. And then they subject it to reasoning. So it's not enough just to think it. It's like, yeah, well, will it hold up to reasoning? Because we're going to question you on it. And so they do, and then finally they end up in a position they take. So like the Great Exposition, there's 18 different schools in there. One of them broke off and became the Sutra, the Sautrantika position. And as you'll see, when we looked at those other people, Vasubandhu was an expert in the Great Exposition. He actually followed, but he was actually a holder of sutra. That was where he really came from, but he was an expert in both. He actually was one of the founders of the sutra school. But then his brother, Asanga, was really worried about him. His brother, Asanga, was a Mahayanist in the other schools, right? Got really worried about him because he thought, man, you're wrong. You know, you don't have the correct view here, and I don't want you to die without the correct view. So he had a long conversation with a Sangha, and then he changed and became Mahayanist and mind only. And so he changed his idea. Now, and this is a sort of relationship, a little relationship. You've got the, you know, I haven't gone in there, but there's like 18 different systems within this one here. Then we have the Sautrantika or the Sutra school, Chittamatra mind only, and middle way. They're the four major ones. But in the Sautrantika, you've got two others called those who follow scripture and those who follow reasoning. And this is where we have Dignaga and Dharmakirti, the great thinkers, born into reasoning. Then in the mind only, we've got Chittamatrans who follow scripture and Chittamatrans who follow reasoning. These are two major big things. But within there, you've also got smaller systems. You have the middle way. Again, we have this, what they call the autonomy school. We've got two schools, and one really follows the Chittamatra, one is after the sutra. And then we have consequence. But like I said, so within these, this is just the really basic out. Within them, there are all these ways of sort of thinking. And they're talking, oh, they go this way and they go that way. But when these people were thinking about this, they were not called Sautrantika or mind only or anything. They were just people thinking about it. All of this, how this division came, was much, much later in Tsongkhapa's time. That was the Galupas of it. You know, take all this and work with it. And so this idea of breaking it all up is just a way to help you work with it. Understand, oh, these ideas, we can put them into this category. That'll help me think about this. That's its major thing. It's just like going to the library. We don't put all the books everywhere, right? It's hard to work with it like that. We categorize them, right? Under authors and subject. It's the same here.
And you can enjoy books from all the different sections too.
Yep,
in that case, right. You don't have to just go, I'm just in this little corner over here.
No, that's right. You can move from all over the library. And that's what you would do as a philosopher. You just keep moving. You know, you're thinking, you find, wow, that doesn't hold up. And they go, yeah, somebody else knew that, and guess what? And you go along and have a look at them, and you think. I was really interested when I started reading about Lama Tsongkhapa's coming to the view. You know, so they said he used to carry, when he traveled, he had three, what they call zo. And the zo is the cross between a yak and an ox. And they were piled high with books, right? Wherever he went. And they said, the Lama Sangha, when he wasn't meditating and teaching, he was reading day and night, over and over and over again.
So a bit like Lama Sangha Rinpoche nowadays, he's like Rinpoche with his little, tiny little bag of stuff and then three enormous suitcases of sutras.
Yeah, that's right, so wherever you go. And, you know, of course, the words of the text don't change, but your understanding does. And it's the same with us reading and studying over the years. Eh? You'll notice how your mind has changed. You read this, you thought, listen, 7 years ago, but 7 years have passed, you look at now, it's not like that anymore. It's the same thing here. Just keep going through time, and your understanding is refined and refined and refined. Now, like you see, so I've coloured these different ways, right? So one is in green and one is in blue. And that's, again, to divide it up into the individual schools and the universal schools, the Hinayana systems that lead to individual liberation in the green, and the blue, the Mahayana, great vehicle tenet systems. So what the major differences here are, in the individual vehicle, the Vaibhashika Sautrantika or Great Expositional Sutra, their view of selflessness is only towards the person. They deal just with individual selflessness. Where in the Mahayana, it's the person and everything else. Everything. It's all empty. The individual vehicle schools of the Great Exposition and Sutra seem to be like realist schools. So in other words, it's like, you know, I said before, it's like there's a real world here that we're in. And I'm a real person, but there's no real self. Everything else is real, but the self is not. And that's what I call, you know, the selflessness of the individual person. The person doesn't have a self that exists in a particular way, which we'll see shortly. The self the person is empty of is a person who is permanent, independent, singular, then self-sufficient and substantially existent. No such person like that. A person doesn't have a self like that. Do persons exist? Yeah, sure they do. They're right here in front of us. We're talking to one another. But they don't have a self, which is, I think you normally do, not like that. Because their goal is personal liberation, they don't speak about any obstructions to omniscience, because that's not their goal. But the Mahayana do, because there are obstructions to becoming a Buddha. Over here, those obstructions are not to Buddhahood. They have afflictive obstructions which prevent your own individual liberation. And that's what they deal with. And of course, they don't speak of the bodhisattva grounds. They accept that there are bodhisattvas. Bodhisattvas exist. But that's not their interest. They don't talk about that. Their interest is personal liberation, the arahat. That's their goal. In the Mahayana, of course, bodhisattva idea, Buddhahood being the goal. So of course, there's different things to talk about there. Now, what they're all negating, of course, is self. So what does self refer to? Inherent existence or ignorance, this deep ignorance, innate deep ignorance. And so there are these ways you can explain what we are empty of. And they turn it in terms of making it as easy and hard. When it's easy, someone's called gross. And this is this one where they start off by saying, look, there is no self that is unchanging, unitary, and autonomous. That's the simple one. And this is the way that all the non-Buddhists who believe in a self that exists like absence, many non-Buddhists, they go, no such thing. They attack that. Then a more deeper level of the self being something real and the controller and owner of the body and mind, the possessor of it, the director of it. And it's within here, because it can be anywhere else. Then they attack that and go, no such self. And nearly all the Buddhist tenet systems except the middle way consequence school will stop right there and go, that's it, done deal. You've achieved it. Even you do this, you have personal liberation too, according to these tenet systems. The middle way consequence go, no, it's not. You have an intrinsic sense of self. There's a sense of an intrinsic being or me. That has to be negated. And unless you do negate that, you will not have the personal liberation you're seeking, nor will you have Buddhahood. So it's even much more subtle. So emptiness of inherent existence is referring to this level here of intrinsic. And later on when we talk about dependent arising, we're talking about really dependent upon words and awareness. Now this type of emptiness or selflessness was described in the Heart Sutra. But the question is, like, why is that sutra called that? Heart. Well, the answer basically is it's the essence of all the different teachings on emptiness pulled together and put into one very short teaching, about 25 lines, I think it's 25 or 33. Very brief. It's called the heart, the essence of it all. And in that, there's this wonderful section called the Four Profundities. Four profound things. And so what they do is they take one object that does exist and they show you the four profundities in relationship to that thing. But then what the idea is, you take one thing and then you apply it to all the other things. So the first thing they take is form, meaning anything physical. All things physical can be contained in this. So there are four profound things we can say about anything physical. The first thing we can say is that this form is empty. So everything that is physical is empty. And this is the ultimate truth about form, about anything physical. Then it says, and as I said, this is the ultimate, so I've made that in a lighter color. The other darker colors all have to do with the conventional nature of form. But here, I need to remind you, it's the subtle conventional nature of form. So it's saying here that the form is because, why? Because emptiness is a very subtle phenomenon. In fact, it's the most subtle phenomenon. And we're talking about the emptiness of inherent existence here. So it goes, the emptiness is form. Not only is form empty and empty is form, that these two are one single entity. The emptiness is not other than form. The form also is not other than emptiness. That's saying that we can talk about form and its emptiness. So we have this, what you call the nominally distinct.
We can talk about them, but we can't separate.
No, you can't separate. You can separate them only through language and through ideas, but in their reality, they're not separate. And it was really talking, like in here we say they're nominally distinct, meaning you can talk about the ultimate nature of form, its emptiness, or you can talk about form itself. You can talk about the colour of form, you can talk about the shape of form. You can talk about all the conventionalities of form, right? But you can also talk about its ultimate nature, it's empty. So this is how we have this nominally distinct. But the colour, the shape, all these things as conventional things are ultimately empty. And the reason for that is because the form is a dependent arising.
Is that similar to the analogy of the two sides of a coin? So you can't separate out the sides of a coin from a coin?
Yeah, you can get the chance to use that analogy. And the thing is, the wonderful thing about it is that the metal pervades both sides of the coin. Right? So if you look at it, if you have a gold coin, right, the one side is the head, one side is the tail. Right? So the head is not the tail is not the head. Right? Two different things. But the gold goes right across both. So emptiness is empty, form is empty too. Everything's empty. And the tail is not somewhere off from different places
and,
the head,
and,
right?
And so because they're empty, it doesn't then mean that the tail and the head are the same.
No, that's right, they're not the same.
So yeah. That's the nominally distinct.
Yeah, that's right. Yep. Yeah, well, using the example of the coin, we can talk about the material of the coin, the gold, we could talk about the head, and we could talk about the tail. You've got all these different aspects of the coin. But right across the walls, it's gold. It's all the same. And so here, so it's empty. It goes right across. Now, to discover these four profundities, there are many different ways you can do it. And in particular, if you look at all the different ways and just drill them down and go, well, here's a really simple way of looking at it. There are five types of meditation you can use. The best and the easiest is called dependent arising. It's called the kingdom of reasons. And the second is reasoning establishing the lack of being one or many. Both of these types of meditations are also dealing with the emptiness of phenomena. So you go, what phenomena? Persons and everything else. But they were both sides. You get this one, you got the lot. The next one, called diamond slivers, is really working at produced phenomena. You're looking at here how causes are empty and effects are empty, and the conditions needed to produce the effect are empty. They're all dependent arisings. So this is really, again, like this is really looking at the phenomena, but phenomena in terms of produced phenomena. They're empty of inherent existence. The next two, fivefold reasoning and sevenfold reasoning, are dealing just with the emptiness of the person. The fivefold reasoning, I think, is Nagarjuna, and sevenfold reasoning from Chandrakirti. You might have come across sevenfold reasoning where they use the example of the chariot. You know, they break it down as the chariot of its parts. Is it separate from the parts? Is it the shape of the parts? All these different things go, no, 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 no. Therefore, a chariot cannot inherently exist. How does it exist? Dependent. So these are the five ways you can do it. Like I said, the Lama Tsongkhapa and the Buddha himself said, if you want to understand emptiness, come at it through dependent arising. It's the simplest way. So when we use emptiness, is what we're trying to refute here is not everything that exists. We're just trying to refute inherent existence. So what's that saying is that we have the things that exist, and they're appearing to us as if they inherently exist. And if we don't know that they're just appearances, we think it's real. The wisdom of realizing emptiness challenges that assumption that it's real. So we use the wisdom to see if it's real, and then we discover it's not. Now that discovery does not say the object doesn't exist. It just tells you it doesn't exist inherently. So there are some mistakes like we have about ourselves. So we're going to look at some of these now. So the first is that we have a self, and the analogy is like, and the self is like the person carrying something. You go like, what's that? Well, self. There we are, we all have a self. So it says, and the different names they give is like self, Atman, and soul. Soul theory. So you see here, they're different phenomena. They're not the same phenomena. A person and the self are not the same. A person has a self, the self is different. A person has a soul, it's different than the person. A person has Atman, it's different than the person. They're different phenomena here. In the Buddhist go, no way. We disagree. Here are our reasons for doing so. This is impossible to exist like this. So here are the three things that this is referring to. I am permanent, I am independent, I am singular. You refute it all through reasoning. The reason is here. If I were permanent, single, and independent, it would mean this. I am not produced, I'm not subject to subtle change. You take that idea on, the consequences of this are, if you are suffering, you can't be freed. It's impossible for you to be free if this is the view you took. Secondly, being single, you have no parts, and you can't be consciousness or the body, because the consciousness has parts and the body has parts. So you can't be divorced. And this is actually the idea of self up and soul, isn't it? That I'm something completely different from my body and my mind. I'm soul. And this is what I heard quite a lot at the funeral on the weekend. Yeah. Now everyone believes in the soul theory, but something is different than all that. So of course I didn't go and ask him, say, well, how? No, I did not do that. In fact, my friend's ex-wife was there, and she says, oh, what do you do? And I've been living in a Buddhist center, and I've been sort of teaching Buddhist philosophy for a little while, you know? And she said, straight away, I'm a Christian. I said, yeah, we've got a lot in common. And, you know, if you're independent, then you're not dependent. So then you either have always existed or you've never existed. Or you've been created by something else. So that's, you can all, these are all refuted through reasoning and the consequences.
We can see this running through so much in our society.
Ah, yeah, yes.
It's everywhere. Even amongst a whole stack of people that say, I'm not religious in any way and I don't believe in anything, this all runs through.
That's right, this will run through. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. All those things, that's right, sir. So, yeah, it's all, you know, if you look at it and go, yeah, but then you look at your own behaviour. And if I'm at, yeah, but I'm behaving like that, you go, wow, I want to be.
Psychological terms, but it's actually has this at its basis when we're saying those derogatory things like I'm bad or I'm no good,
never was, or
that.
Yeah, straight off, isn't it? Because you're not talking about your body, and you're not talking about your mind, you're talking about something that's independent of them. And it's like, look, there ain't no self that exists like that, right? And yet we talk about ourselves, and we get the effects of talking about ourselves like that as unnecessary suffering. And this is what the Buddha's pointing out, like, yeah, you don't exist like that. But, you know, you still carry out actions, isn't there? It's like, you know, so here we've got the causes of suffering. A wrong misapprehension of who we are, bad knowledge. From the bad knowledge, actions follow, and they create suffering, and we experience it. So then there's another idea. Okay, so we go, okay, yes, I'm not like that. Okay, that's all right. But there's still, I'm still here, aren't I? You go, yep. And you still use my arms and legs. You go, yep. And I still think, yep. So you have a mind, yes. You have a body, yes. So how does it exist? Well, it appears to us to be some sort of self-sufficient thing, a substantial entity. Now, this one also doesn't make any sense. Like I said, it's like a shepherd directing their sheep. So the shepherd is not the sheep, the sheep is not the shepherd. There's something independent of them again. So here we've got this independence idea. But again, you know, it means if you're not dependent upon the body and mind, then you can exist without a body and mind. You don't rely on anything else, it then means you can be observed, but you can't be. Sorry, I'll go back. So, yeah, basically, so that's it in a nutshell. Now, like I said, so, you know, we've done a few meditations here where we just go, well, if I did exist in a self-sufficient and substantial way, this would be the consequence, if I did exist like that. But then you see, obviously, that's not happening. So you've got to go, so I don't exist like that. Not only have I done it through reasoning, I've done it through a meditative exercise to see if it's true. Right? And you go like I said, I do it in the shower all the time. You know, you hop out and you go, well, if you were like this, someone's in the shower and someone's out. Like the body's in the shower, but I'm out. No. So I don't. So again, so this is another, it's more subtle, but we're still progressing. So remember here, the simplest way is like, this is, we're saying independent, not the same. Right? So the lower systems, that's their view. It's something like I said, independent. So if you're not independent, what's left? Yeah, dependent, or if you, yeah, so you've got the dependent, but what can often happen is that you are that. If you're not something separate from it, you are that. So then people think, I am my body, I am my mind, I'm not independent, I am. And this is the thing with the ignorance, we keep slipping off that way, and then we'll slip off this way. So that's what's interesting, when you do these exercises, the grasping at the body or mind to be me. Because it's like this thing, if you weren't, you wouldn't exist at all.
It's very feelings oriented. Oh, you grasp it like that, like the body is me,
yeah.
Until something happens, like you have a leg amputated, and then you go, oh no, it wasn't actually. Now I'm over on this other side, and it's all just emotions, feeling based according to.
Yeah. So if you're in hospital, like I was saying on the weekend, I got a shock, you know, like I haven't seen this guy for 40 odd years. I patted him on the leg like, this is that, it's great to see you, mate. And I just hit metal, and there was no leg there. So, you know, now think about that. I think, well, what if you're in hospital, and they're going to take your leg off? Right? Now, for most people, you wouldn't be just the guy, yeah, well, just take the leg. I mean, people do think like that, but it's that leg is part of me. Like, if there's that clinging to your body as being me, that is going to be traumatic. Then they take it away and you go, oh, I'm still okay.
I'm still here. And then suddenly it's become my leg, not me.
That's right. That's my leg.
Beforehand, you've got like, no, don't just, if you destroy my body, you're destroying me.
You're destroying me. And it's the same with the mind, isn't it? Like all you have to, that's what the torturers do. They threaten these aspects of yourself and you grasp it as being, that's me. You're hurting me. Don't hurt me. We say. So here we have the grasping at the parts to be me, the whole. Anyway, so these are these different funny ways we behave, and of course it's all drawn, we all create unnecessary suffering, but that's how it sort of works. And that's what I mean by the ignorance. Believing something is untrue to be true, you act on it, and you get these effects. And they're really sort of unreliable, unpleasant, all the rest. So all we've talked about so far is what we're not. So then it's like, you have to pause, well, okay, great, you tell me what you're not, but you haven't told me who I am. That's what I'm really interested in. So still staying on the lower systems, the person is something inexpressible. We can't really say. If you're not the body, and you're not the mind, and you're not independent of them, like, who are you?
That sounds suspiciously like poetry to me.
Yeah, well, these are the guys that are saying, yeah, they it's inexpressible. We can't actually say, and they don't. Others are saying you're the collection of the body and mind. In Sutra, they go, again, they use the same things, this was an offshoot from the Vaibhashika system. Inexpressible. The mere collection of all five aggregates, the continuum of the five aggregates. Mental consciousness. So you've got different points of view in here. So, you know, we had sutra according to scripture and reasoning. So different ideas about who the person is. So
the mere collection of five aggregates? Do they use
the mere in the same way? No, they don't. So this is, again, so you see same words used, but the meaning being different, depends upon the context you use it in. So if you use the word mere with the lower tenant systems, it has a different meaning than it does in the higher systems.
What does it mean?
Yeah, it's sort of, it's not merely labeled.
Is it,
it's not that.
The aggregates are real, but the collection is near.
Maybe. I'm not sure. I'm not sure. But I can find out. So then we come to the Mahayana systems, the bigger systems. And they're, like I said before, they're interested in the selflessness of the person, but they take it to be everything. So it gets a bit more difficult here. And their challenge here is these guys go, you guys have told us what's real and what's not. And what's not real is a real self. But everything else is real. It's okay, explain how it's real. And so they do, and they say, well, there are these partless moments. Like, for all the things that make up the world, for instance, like the world is, well, is all made up of these parts, but there's got to be, it can't be nothing, so there's got to be something. So that's something, whatever that is, that's the smallest thing there is. So we, you know, one stage for us was the atom. Then it became the center of the atom. Now it's even something smaller, 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 right? And they're saying, without that thing there, there'd be nothing. There's got to be something. That's what they call realists. Right? There's really something there. And it's the same with consciousness. They go, there's got to be something there, because if it's not there, there's nothing there. And physicists go, yeah, that's right, right. So the mind only go, oh yeah, well, this is what would happen if it were that way. They ask you some questions about them. If you have these really tiny, tiny, tiny moments, how do all these tiny things that are all different from one another make the bigger things? Do they meet each other? If they do, then they've got sides. Right, so there's one side and another side. So that's two things there.
So is that like trying to have a coin that's just one-sided?
Yeah, one thing. It's like, no, you've got problems. So they go, no, we have no faith at all in an external world that's real like that. So what's their answer? There is no external world like that which is not reliant on the mind. So what can we be sure of that does exist? The mind. Does it have all those partless moments of consciousness? No. So the mind is the real thing. So before it was the, you know,
the
outside world is like a real thing, and your internal world is all real, but a self that possesses it all is independent. No, that's not real. That doesn't exist. Mind only go, you're right. We agree with that, but you haven't gone far enough. What's only actually real is mind. So they present this presentation. And this is like a middle way step between the middle way position. But this is like a reasonable step. But it's very interesting in terms of philosophy, if you wanted to sort of think it through and, you know, think
well,
of people's reasoning.
Development.
Yeah, that's right. So they're dealing with the selfless of phenomena, and what they work out is that subject and object are not different entities. Like before, like the person and the self, they're different. They're different and they're independent. And mind only goes, yeah, no such self like that. The other guys go, yeah, no such self like that. We agree. But here it's like, but the subject and like so the object appear to be different, don't they? Like I said, you're here, look up at the sky is to be blue, it's a different object. And the awareness that knows it is different. And they're saying it's not. It's not different. They're not separate like that.
They're saying it's all awareness.
Yeah.
It's all mind.
Yeah, and then you've got to explain how that is. So that's really interesting with what we know about modern physics, you know, and how you get to see a blue sky. Because it's actually, there is no blue sky out there. What appears to be blue is created by your own mind. It's created by your physiology and your mind. That's true. But it's like, well, hang on a minute, what about, you know, you get the explanation of these little particles that hit surfaces and come into the eye. That's not all mind, is it? You know, so you've got these differences of opinion. And lastly, the phenomena are not naturally the basis of a name. But basically, they're sort of getting at the same things. And so, of course, you know, we can't go into this in much more depth. In fact, I've only got about 10 minutes left. So, but I just want to point out some of the differences here, because they do ask me questions about this. So you go, like, who's the person then? So the Maya notice will present not just six types of consciousness, but eight. And don't think that's too unusual, because there's others that present three and another presents one. So you've got one, three, six, and eight. In fact, there's another that does nine. So they've got all these different philosophical models trying to work out who we
they're
are.
They're trying to get the theory of everything.
That's right. That's right. That's right. The theory of everything. They're trying to get that. So they present, okay, we've got a, who's the person? They've got this mind basis of all. Or mental consciousness. Then we have this middle way autonomy system. And they're also interested in the selflessness of phenomena. And what they come up with is that phenomena does not truly exist. Again, so they come up with this term here called true existence. And these people have a way of explaining what that means. And the middle way also have a way of explaining, and they're different. Same words, different meanings. And this is not unusual. The Buddha did this himself often. He would take concepts that already existed in Indian philosophy and change them. So who's the person in the middle way autonomy? Well, they're the mental consciousness too. So if you see here, it's like this thing of, it's like there's something that we've got to be calling this thing. So what's the thing? It's the person. Well, you can't just have a word and go, well, that's it. It's like, it's got to be related to something. What is it? Yeah, the mental consciousness. That's the person. That's our example of the person.
So then do you start asking, so what type of mental consciousness?
Well, so the middle way consequent school are not happy with any of these answers. They don't accept any of these answers. They say when you do that, when you're looking for something and you're saying that's it, that's inherent existence right there. So if such a person did exist, if an inherently existent person existed, one of the things you could say if you remembered back to Chandrakirti and Lama Tsongkhapa, is a person could exist without dependence. That's what inherent existence means. There is dependence and without dependence. Without dependence is inherent existence. So you think, okay, so I'm going to say a person can exist inherently. What would that mean? What would be a consequence? You say, well, a person could be known by means without any awareness of the person. That would be a consequence. Because the person, because dependence, there's no dependence on it. So can you know somebody without depending upon awareness? Do you know anything without depending upon awareness? The answer is no. So if persons could be known, the appearance and reality of an inherently established person would mean that they do not depend upon awareness. So it'd be like if Sue were not in the room, yet Sue would be there. I could know Sue if she was there. No, I'm not. that doesn't work. But yet that's how we often work. You know, the simple idea you can get it is just walk out of the room and think, well, do you think one of those chairs and desks is still there? You go, yeah. But you have no awareness of it other than the thought that was there. And most times we'll come back and go, yeah, it's there. See, I told you. But one day you walk in and it's not. If you saw it was. And that's the idea of inherent existence, that things exist without any reliance upon your awareness or consciousness. We do that a lot. So here we come, middle way consequence system. Again, you know, they're also, they've done emptiness of persons, emptiness of phenomena, all these schools. They're saying that the person does lack a self-sufficient and substantial existence, just like all the other schools before them. They go, yep, you're right. But that is not the end, as all you guys think it was. You guys all think, if we just realize that, we got it. You know who's going to say, no, wrong. There's still grasping going on. And that is the grasping at inherent existence. This idea that things could exist without dependence upon your awareness. Like I said, if you just walk out of the room and think, yeah, there's a chair, the chair is still, that one over there is still there. There it is. It's like you have no awareness of it, but you're out there thinking what you think is true.
So there's a thing in science where they talk about that actually there are multiple universes because each one of us has our own universe because it depends on that, on how we're conceiving of it and responding to it.
Yep.
So it's kind of getting to this that it's the mind, it's dependent on the mind, but they go back into grasping it at reality again of saying, therefore, there are existing all these different universes at the same time, individually, separately.
Yeah, long answer. Yeah, the Buddha says one of the things. So the Buddha says the three worlds are mind. Which is just what I'm saying there. So you're in the form realm, the formless realm, or desire realm, they're all mind. So the mind only school takes that literally. The middle way consciousness doesn't take it literally.
Right.
Yeah, and that's all imputed to mind, where the other guy's mind. It's like reality really is.
Uh-huh.
That's the difference. Yeah. So, okay, that's all very well, but then who are we? What are we? And they go, you are a mere I. The person's the mere I. That's how they exist. Mere persons. So what does this word mere mean here? It means that when you search for the identity, I, you don't find it. It doesn't have substantial existence, it doesn't have sufficient existence, it doesn't have inherent existence.
And yet there's someone searching for it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So what you find, first of all, is what you're not. There's an assumption of what you are, and the hard thing is to come back and discover everything you're not. It's like, so what am I? How have I come to exist as this mere I? This is the conclusion, I merely exist. So last night I read up to Biffy, Lama Tsongkhapa's discovery when he realized emptiness. Right? So what he said was that what became really more and more and more clear to him was dependent arising. Things dependent. It was really, really clear. See, that's what the actual impact of it was. The cause and effect worked. How? Merely. In terms of language and awareness. It all works.
So that's having an incredibly stable mind because he's not flipping over to any extreme or grasping, just like
And so Lama Tsongkhapa said in this journey of discovery, there is flipping, right? But he's saying when it's still flipping, you haven't got it yet.
Mm-hmm.
But when it stops, you've got it. And that's what Manjushri told him. Like, this is this thing. And so then you get this advice in the text. And this is the other thing. It was a great part of when you wrote to Rindava, his teacher, saying, his discovery, the normal way of saying things is that appearances are empty because they lack inherent existence, I think. Anyway, what he did, he reversed the whole understanding of what was traditionally known before. And so the old understanding is still accepted, but he could flip it, and this was this new thing. This is exactly what Manjushri had said to me. He said, I can see it now, so I don't need to go flip. It's appearances are empty because they're dependent arising. Yeah. And emptiness, that's right.
Because there's emptiness, there are appearances.
That's right. Yeah. And all appearances are empty. So this is something that's very useful for us to take this view of going, here's the appearance, it's empty. Yeah, why? Because it's dependent. Now, so Manjushri said to get this, purify the mind, but purify your body, speech, and mind. Accumulate as much wisdom and good acts as you possibly can, and then regard your teacher and the deity to be indivisible. And what will happen if you can do this, you will have an authentic refuge. Because our actual refuge is true cessation, is true paths. True cessation is emptiness, is nirvana. But we've got to realize it. So we need a path that realizes it. That gives us an authentic refuge. Personal freedom, and lastly, Buddhahood itself, and everything between all those steps. So what's it mean for us? Well, be very careful. There are consequences. Everything you say, think, and act upon, there's a consequence. We get a lot wiser because all these actions, the person acting, and the consequences are empty of any intrinsic nature. It's all dependent. There's a snow. Things don't just stop.
So is that how we can know we're on the right track, is if we do become very careful rather than become kind of blasé and go, oh, well, it's all empty anyway, so it doesn't matter.
No, that's where you've got to be really careful. When you say it's all empty, you mean it's all dependent. You mean there's consequences. That's what you've got to come back to. And one of the major, major, major consequences is that we are the creators of our own experiences. So therefore, we are in control of our future. Therefore, enlightenment is possible. Like I say, remember here, the wisdom it realizes is the antidote to its opposite, inherent existence. Grasping an inherent existence, thinking things are true when they're false, is the source of all of our problems. When you see that things, they're not non-existence, they exist dependently. But from that is a natural, that's a basis for a natural system of ethics. Because you realize, one of the things that we all realize is that, oh my God, if I'm suffering, I'm part of it, I'm creating it. If one part is some part of me, that's involved in the creation of my own suffering. So you can ask, so what am I doing? It's doing it. You say, well, your senses are providing the starter of the world that's appearing to you to be inherently existent. You think it's true. You're acting as if it's true. And there you create all your suffering. What if you realize it wasn't true? And yet there are still things like, for instance, suffering is important. Happiness is important. Yeah, but you know, suffering is a consequence of belief in a false way of existing and acting in dependence upon it. What if I didn't do that? Well, you wouldn't have the suffering, would you? Why not? Because you're not, you can't create it unless you put the causes and conditions in. And you're not. And so this is what the Buddha says very quickly. First of all, restrain yourself. You don't have to change the whole world, just restrain yourself. So it's like, okay,
zip the lip,
change my, you know, this wrong ideas that I've got. I won't keep engaging in the wrong idea. I won't do the behaviors that I'm associated with my wrong ideas. I'll restrain myself. Then you go, okay, so I've got to work in harmony, isn't it? So just as I don't want to experience suffering, neither does anyone else. You know that when you cause someone else suffering, you cause yourself suffering. It's a natural consequence. When you help others be happy, you help yourself be happy. It's a natural consequence. It's just cause and effect. So if you want to be happy, there's a way of behaving. Stop suffering, here's another way of behaving. And over time, you know, we take control of our future. We know that enlightenment is possible. we know how the mind exists and so forth, and we work with what we understand to be true. So our takeaways is here, you've got some understanding of these two truths, of natural, what we call relative truth and ultimate truth. But phenomena are both empty and dependently existent. This is really important to remember. Don't just go the empty side and don't go just the dependent. They're related. In fact, one is just a synonym for the other. And to try and use this understanding as much as possible in two ways. One is like restraining yourself from what doesn't work and doing what you can, which does work. Because we're here, aren't we? You know, we're never going to go out of existence. That's the thing. We're just going to change our appearances. We'll be here for a little while, then we'll be called dead, and then, hello, going to be somebody else with a different name. On and on and on, and if it's happening in an uncontrolled fashion, we'll experience suffering all the time. It's the different types. And you can take some control over it through understanding the wisdom, realizing the interest, and from a practice, do it. Can change the whole scenario. So I've come to the end of our class, folks online, folks here, something to think about and try and apply, especially, like I said, we can all apply dependent horizons, dependent relationships. We can work there. And that's actually working with emptiness. So there are two sets of exams in the books. Choose any one you like if you want to. Email them in if you want, or if you just want to do an interview, but we'll just use the questions so you can just talk it through with me, that's fine. And then our next unit is Discovering Buddhism, called Introduction to Tantra, and that will be led by Miffy, with an I, another while.
Luckily, I'm not.
That's right, as you said, that's what, I don't know how to spell my name.
Oh,
that's right, it's an I, not a Y. So, let's dedicate our merits, because we've created some, and we don't want to hang on to them, we're going to dedicate them. Due to these merits, for these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of the Guru Buddha and lead all living beings, without exception, into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel, bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline, but increase forevermore. And as long as space endures, and as long as sentient beings abide, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world.